The winds on Hanko had always presented a problem to starships, or any flying machine, whether they used ingrav or regrav. The pressure which the unpredictable turbulence produced on the hull pushed the vessels about as they neared the ground. At high altitude it didn't really matter. Precision wasn't necessary above the cloud level. But close to the ground it became more of a problem. Squalls and microbursts could shove the whole ship down unexpectedly, bringing it perilously close to a crash. As a consequence, nothing flew below 800 meters unless they were landing at Jajani. That was in ordinary conditions. As the planet's frozen surface began to quake and buckle prior to its final fatal implosion, the storms accelerated relentlessly, with wind speeds rising to over 200 kilometers an hour. Aeron found there was only one way to fly through such an environment, using the kind of speed and power that no wind could ever effect. The Lindau hit Mach 12 as he took it down to an altitude of 500 meters. At that velocity, through a dense typhoon of hail, it didn't so much fly as rip out a vacuum contrail. Supersonic annular blast waves radiated out from the force field, blasting the ice and soil below to granulated ruin. A thick column of lightning blazed along its roiling wake before discharging into sheets that spread over hundreds of square kilometers. Far above the starship, the upper cloud level bulged and seethed as if some massive creature was clawing at the planetary blanket. Aeron reached the end of his run, and an 8G acceleration vector lifted the Lindau vertical. Seconds later, he was out of the clouds and curving sharply at 10 Gs through the ionosphere to bring the nose down again. The starship's onboard compensators managed to relieve 4 Gs, leaving him exposed to a full 6G force. Bionics braced his body again as he was shoved back into the pilot's acceleration couch. The Lindau plunged back into the lower atmosphere. It immediately began to vibrate with a frequency and intensity that threatened to shake the whole structure apart. Even with bionic protection, Aeron could feel his bones and organs quiver as his flesh was squeezed. Alarms filled the cabin with a panicked howl. Red strobes drowned out the ordinary illumination, immersing him in Hell's own lighting scheme. He heard overstressed metal tearing. Somewhere behind him, high-pressure gas roared out of a fracture. Toxic alarms added their unique note to the clamor. Aeron strengthened his integral force field. Solar bright lightning overwhelmed the hull's visual sensors as the starship began its new run 500 meters from the ground. The vibration grew progressively more violent. Aeron ignored it all, scrutinizing every byte of data from the external sensors. Within the chaos of the terminal blizzard, the ship's instruments could only scan a few hundred meters with any accuracy. His search area was a huge zone that stretched from the Asiatic glacier back to the Olhava camp, which he was forced to cover in strips 800 meters wide, with a 50-meter overlap to be certain of complete coverage. The Lindau completed its manic run and punched upwards. A fuselage stress strut snapped, tearing through cables and pipes. Sparks sprayed into the cabin as half the polyphoto light panels failed. Smart core schematics revealed a deeper problem of primary power loss to several drive support systems. Aeron shunted the display into a peripheral icon and power dived the starship back into the clouds at 11 Gs. The delivery man teleported directly into the hallway to hear Elsie and Tilly squabbling over who could play with the grav ball. Elsie had it, and was running round the front lounge victoriously, holding the toy aloft and shouting, "My turn, my turn!" Tilly was chasing after her sister, trying to grab the ball back. "Is not!" she yelled in frustration. The pediatric housebot was floating after the two of them, maintaining the safety-regulated 1.7 meters away, chiding melodiously. "Children, to stop climbing on furniture. There is danger in this activity. Please calm down. Share your toys. It is rewarding." "Ratbag!" Elsie shouted at the bot. She threw the grav ball. It hit the upper surface of the bot and rebounded in a cloud of blue holographic light to hit the ceiling, where it flattened out for 5 seconds, quivering, before launching itself at the wall amid another photonic fizz. Tilly and Elsie sprinted for it, little faces grim with determination. Both missed it as it shot upwards again, making a ridiculous boing noise. Another bounce off the ceiling and it was heading straight for Lizzie's favourite vase, a 1500-year-old Rebecca Lewis from her Bryn Bella period. The delivery man hated the flowery monstrosity, but managed to snatch the grav ball from the air just before it hit.
Daddy!
Both girls immediately forgot their squabble and ran over for hugs.
I've told you 100 times you're not to play with this in the adult rooms, he scolded.
Yes, yes!
They wrapped their arms around him, tugging as they jumped up and down in happy excitement.
Where have you been?
Did you bring presents?
He handed the grav ball to the housebot.
All over, and no.
Oh!
I was too busy. Sorry.
Staying alive. The three of them walked into the kitchen where Lizzie and a general housebot were preparing supper on the iron range cooker. Various pans were bubbling away, producing a melange of scents. It was dark outside, turning the windows into sheets of blackness coated in condensation. Lizzie smiled and gave him a quick kiss.
Glad you're back, she whispered. Me too.
Rosa tottered in front from the conservatory, dressed in a red and black shirt with green stockings.
Da-da!
Hello, Poppet. He scooped her up and tidied some of her dark red curls.
She said bot today, Lizzie said. Did you?
The delivery man asked. Rosa smiled back, saying nothing.
It could have been boot, Lizzie admitted. Can you three do something useful and lay the table, please?
The delivery man put Rosa down and helped Tilly and Elsie arrange the knives and forks in the right places.
I think I might cut down on investigations, the delivery man said as he found some wine glasses for himself and Lizzie.
That's good, she said.
At least the case is furthest away from the central worlds. That should cut down on my away time considerably.
She rewarded the decision with a kiss.
Thank you.
They all sat down together for supper. The housebot put a big casserole pot in the middle of the table and lifted the lid off. The delivery man poked the serving spoon in and lifted out some steaming...
What is this? He asked dubiously.
Sausage stew, Tilly announced proudly. I made the sausages at school. We programmed the culinary cabinet down to level 3 for the ingredients.
I made the tomatoes, Elsie said.
It all looks lovely, the delivery man assured them.
He tipped the stew onto the plate and added some vegetables and potatoes. Lizzie sipped at the wine and grinned at him over the rim of the glass. When they finally got the children to bed, the delivery man lit the fire in the lounge. The Georgian townhouse was perfectly insulated against the wintry night, but as Lizzie had educated him, a real fire gave them a reassuring warmth inside. They snuggled up together on the big settee with the rest of the wine.
I heard a rumor today, Lizzie said. You know what Jen's husband does?
Not sure, really.
For the first time in a long time, he was actually relaxing rather than putting on a show of tranquility.
Something to do with the Navy. Anyway, she was telling me the Ockerson fleet might be more powerful than anyone is owning up to.
Really?
He knew it was only ever a matter of time before news of the Yenisei got out.
Did you hear anything?
No. But he did remember Marius's reaction to the news of Hanko. It was odd, as though the Accelerator faction representative didn't know about the Hawking M-Sync being used. Why would he try to bluff on that?
And the news from Vyosha was horrible. The Unisphere showed some poor woman being grabbed by the paramilitaries. They'd attacked her in the street for no reason.
Terrible. Unless he genuinely didn't know. And if that's the case, who else would be able to get hold of one?
I can see you're really bothered by it.
Sorry.
It's okay. She wiggled up closer. I'm glad you're cutting back.
You don't mind?
I can pick it up again in 20 years. I just don't want to miss out on the kids growing up.
It's a unique time.
Lizzie patted his leg as she tipped back some more wine.
Good man.
While the delivery man was getting ready for bed that night, the conservative faction called. We need you to deliver a starship to Pulap tomorrow.
No,
he told them. A quick, guilty glance through the bathroom door showed Lizzie moving round in the bedroom. He shut the door.
Not anymore.
This will be an entirely passive role for you, exactly as we originally promised. To the best of our knowledge, there are no agents of any faction on Pulap.
If he catches me, you'll need to relife me. I don't want that.
There is someone else we will be using to monitor Marius from now on, an operative who takes a more active role than you.
Oh.
To reassure you further, Marius has just arrived on Ganthia.
What's on Ganthia?
He immediately cursed himself for asking. We're not sure. However, it is over 200 light years from Pulap. We would not ask you to make this delivery unless it was urgent.
I don't know.
It will take us time to replace you. There was bound to be some overlap before your successor can be fully initiated.
I didn't say I was going to stop helping you.
He gave his image in the mirror an angry stare, then broke away and stuffed his clothes into the laundry basket.
All right. I'll deliver the starship. But after this, I want at least 3 days' notice of any assignment.
Thank you. Araminta didn't sleep much. The bed which the couch expanded into was fine, its aging mattress accommodating and the duvet warm. The twins next door made no noise to bother her. It was all due to worry. Worry that any second the door would come crashing down and the Alezalin paramilitaries would rampage through the little house to grab her, hurting Tandra and the children in the process. I had no right to come here and put them in danger. Worry also about what to do next. She knew who she wanted to talk to, but the how of it was difficult. In the hours she wasn't actively fretting, she went through all the communication technology files stored in her lacuna. There were more than she realized, accumulated so she could hardwire her properties for Unisphere access and integrate domestic systems with the house net. They gave her quite a good base of practical knowledge. All she had to do then was work out how to apply it. She kept examining the whole problem like some particularly stupid program. If A doesn't work, try B, then C. She was on Z for about the 8th time, when morning finally started to glow through the cheap paper blinds over the window. But that 8th Z was certainly possible, maybe even quite clever. It also had the big advantage that no one would be able to predict it. That was the crucial part. She wasn't under any illusions now about how desperate Living Dream was to catch her. Every aspect of her life would be analyzed for clues, and everyone would be pursued. Araminta sat up as Tandra tried to tiptoe through the living room to the galley kitchen.
Sorry, Tandra said. Did I wake you? No.
Tandra pulled the blinds up.
Wow, you look terrible.
Didn't sleep much, Araminta admitted. Martin emerged from the bathroom, dressed in a worn t-shirt and blue shorts.
Morning, he mumbled, scratching his hair, then moving on to his armpit.
Still glad you came? Tandra asked lightly. She and Araminta started giggling as Martin frowned at the pair of them. He walked through the archway to the kitchen.
Can I steal some of your makeup?
Araminta asked when she heard him banging cups and bowls about.
Hell yes, honey, Tandra said, half the membrane scales away past their expiry date. But that's all a big con anyway. You use them. I sure don't get much chance to doll up.
Thanks.
You're going to see a guy?
Not quite, no.
Okay. You want some coffee?
Araminta smiled. The coffee Martin had produced from the galley kitchen last night had been terrible.
Lovely. Thank you.
Breakfast was a messy affair, with the five of them squeezed round the little table in the living room. The twins were playing up, taking forever to scoop down their cereal. Araminta munched on her toast, trying not to laugh as an increasingly exasperated Tandra threatened and pleaded with the children. Afterwards, she sat on the bed in Tandra's room and started applying the makeup scales. Tandra had a surprising number of cosmetic cases from various companies. Some had been heavily used while others were still untouched. Over half an hour, Araminta managed to change the appearance of her features, disguising her rounded cheeks in favor of a more angular quality. Careful shadowing under her jaw made it appear more prominent and square. Simple lenses changed her eye color to a deep blue. She sprayed her hair, darkening it to near raven, then plaited it in a way she hadn't done since high school. Tandra brought her clothes in.
Clean and fixed as best our poor old bot can manage. I must find a better stitching program.
She dropped them on the mattress next to Araminta.
Now that's different. I barely recognize you.
Araminta flashed her friend a grateful smile. Thanks. Don't want to worry you, Tandra said, closing the door, but Matthew just called. There have been people in Nick's this morning asking after you. 3 lots of people. Oh, Ozzy. All the fear and panic from yesterday came storming back into her mind. Tandra sat beside her. Is it bad? About as bad as it can get. I'm going to leave right now. I should never have come. That's all right, honey. I could do with my life shaking up a bit. Araminta shook off her borrowed robe and began pulling her patched trousers on. Not like this. Listen, if anyone comes asking for me, you tell them the complete truth. All of it. What's to tell? That I was here. Don't deny anything. Don't hold back. Gee, if you're sure. She pulled on her blouse, marveling that Tandra's cleaner had managed to get the grass stains out of the elbows. Never more so. With the tool belt round her waist again and the fleece covering it up, she was ready to leave. Thank you again, she said at the door. Martin's uncertain grin only made her feel more ashamed. You take care now, Tandra said, and kissed her goodbye. Araminta walked fast for the first 20 minutes, close to a jog, putting as much distance as she could between her and Tandra's family. After that, with sweat soaking into her blouse, she slowed a little, puffing away, hoping her flushed cheeks wouldn't dislodge the cosmetic membranes. She couldn't open the fleece to cool off. That would expose her tool belt. It was a long way to her destination, an office over in the Salisbury district, which was on the other side of town from Tandra's place. Quickest route would be straight through the centre, but she avoided that, anxious not to encounter too many people. Besides, there were more street sensors in the centre, so she walked in a long curve away from the river, then back down the slope to the north of the docks. 3 hours after she started, she was in Salisbury. The buildings here were nearly all commercial, interspaced with a few estates of cheaper housing that had been shipped in from the Suvorov continent, prefab aluminium brick rooms locked together into bungalows in whatever configuration suited the landlord. Their gardens were marked off with chain-link fencing, containing straggly lawns or big areas of gravel chip, with several parked ground vehicles and the odd broken capsule. The metro line cut through the center of the district, with a small number of branch lines splitting off. A few cabs hummed past. Trike pods were the preferred transport, though there weren't many zipping about today. Bicycles outnumbered them nearly 2 to 1. There were enough pedestrians that she didn't feel too conspicuous. Even the Alezzelin capsules didn't use the skies above Salisbury. Araminta had never been to the district before, so it took her another hour walking down the main roads checking the signs before she found Harrogate Street, a deserted stub of concrete ending 500 metres from the intersection in a big field of rubble from some stalled redevelopment project. Amazingly, a metro line ran all the way to the barrier round the waste ground. The buildings on either side were a mix of offices and industrial units and storage barns. Now she was conspicuous, the only person on the pavement where weeds had started to lift the cracked concrete and compacted rubbish clogged the gutters. A third of the way towards the redevelopment site, she found the building she wanted, a medium-sized warehouse of composite panels and cheap solar roofing. The front had a single-story lean-to built on, housing the company offices. The company in question being Genuine Spanish Crepes, as advertised by a small orange sign on the security-caged front door. The windows were all boarded up with sheets of armored carbetanium, and the side walls covered in graffiti scrawls so old their glow had decayed to near invisibility. Araminta walked down the side of the warehouse. Right at the end of the wall there was a small door. She pulled her cutter out and removed the lock with a neat incision. Inside the big enclosed space, light shone in through a row of misted glass along the roof's apex. There were 5 loosely piled pyramids of boxes on the bare concrete floor, all with the Spanish Crepes logo on the side. She ignored them and hurried back to the offices at the front. Getting inside was easy enough. The door was locked, but not alarmed. Laryl was too cheap for that. There were 3 offices with budget furniture and fittings, looking as if the staff had just left for the day. Araminta hurriedly pulled down the blinds and began to search the offices one by one. Spanish Crepes had been another of Larrell's rotten companies. It was supposed to be a franchise supplying Colwyn City's larger entertainment venues. With dozens of stalls and swarms of eager staff supplying quality food at reasonable prices and paying Larrell for the privilege. As always, it had limped along as he battled with licensing authorities while buying stock from the cheapest suppliers he could find. Then there were subsidiaries dealing in the stalls and culinary units themselves, financed with a buyback scheme based off-world. More interlinked yet unregistered companies provided uniforms and transport. None of it had been declared to the revenue service. Araminta knew about it all because he'd left a file open one day on their apartment's network. She'd never told him she knew about it. She'd even kept it from Cressida. It was to be her very last bargaining point if all legal means failed. A thorough inventory of every desk and cupboard produced very little. Useless hard copy of confusing receipts and agreements. Sample boxes of exotic crepe fillings. Dead pot plants. Worn culinary unit components, electronic modules, function unknown, 3 cybersphere nodes, cubes in neat storage cassettes, a box of company aprons in trial colors, a mid-capacity management array with out-of-date software. However, as she sat at what must have been Larrell's desk with its ancient console and 3 portals, she found 5 cash coins in the bottom drawer, underneath some carry capsule manuals. Difficult to find, but not necessarily suspicious, so they weren't there by accident, like everything Larrell did. She held one of the coins up and smiled at it. Good old Larrell. Dependably unreliable. 30 minutes spent opening up one of the nodes, using a handheld interface to adapt the software configuration, registering a new company Unisphere account with money from the cash coin, and she had a very basic communication link through the management array that didn't involve her U-Shadow or include her identity. No tracer program or scrutineer would be able to place her at the Spanish Crepes office. In theory. She laboriously typed in the Oak-tier code stored in her Lacuna. The tiny array screen printed up icons showing the channel established. Please, she prayed, be curious enough to accept the call. The portal projected Larrell's puzzled face into the air in front of her. She surprised herself by her reaction, but the sight of that awfully familiar thin brown hair, rotund cheeks, and excessive stubble brought tears to her eyes. It was just so unbelievably reassuring that he remained exactly the same as always. Araminta, is that you? Have you reprofiled your face?
Don't go, she blurted. I need help.
Ah. I didn't know you knew about the, crepes company.
Forget about that. Can you run a check to see if anyone is eavesdropping this link?
His eyes widened in amused surprise. Okay. You shadow analyzing the connection route?
Aha!
The channel seems clean, but I'm not a true expert on these things. Are you all right? I've tried to call a couple of times. I was worried when your U-Shadow didn't respond.
Araminta took a deep breath. Larrell. It's me they're after.
You?
I'm the second dreamer.
You know the second dreamer?
No, I am the second dreamer.
You can't be. Araminta scowled at the screen. This was Larrell true enough, always the same and never giving credit.
Why not?
For a start, you don't have Gaia motes.
Don't need them.
She explained about her previously unknown ancestry.
You're related to Melanie Rescari,
was all he asked when she'd finished.
You know of her?
Who doesn't? Especially here on Oak Tier. This was her birth world.
Definitely Larrell. No one else ever irritated her at this level.
She shut her eyes, drew a breath, and looked directly at his projection. I don't know who else to go to. He grinned, a hand reaching up to scratch the top of his right ear.
Wow, I'm flattered.
You said if there was ever anything.
Yeah, wasn't quite thinking along these lines, though.
I see. You can always rely on Larrell to let you down. She reached for the keyboard, ready to cut the channel.
That doesn't mean I won't help,
he said in that soft, caring voice he hadn't used since their first week together. Really? I loved you then, and I guess I always will. Thank you. Sorry, but you're really the second dreamer.
She smirked.
Yeah. And you told the Sky Lord to get lost.
I don't want to go into the void, especially not leading some crazy pilgrimage for a bunch of religious nutters.
Succinctly put, unfortunately there are bigger issues to consider. I know. For a start, I've got half of Alezalin's police force in the city looking for me, and Gore said there are others too.
What can I do?
I don't know. It's just sort of instinct coming to you.
Again, flattering in a weird kind of way, but let's face it, if anyone can advise you how to stay ahead of officialdom, it's me.
I'm not sure even you can help me on that score. Laryl, the whole city is sliding into anarchy. Alezalin is the only authority here. I don't think I can hide forever.
Okay, let me think for a moment here. He patted at his forehead theatrically.
Have you got someone now? She asked quietly.
Yes. At least there's someone I've started to see regularly. She's just arrived on Oak Tier, for the same reason as me.
That's good. I'm pleased.
Thanks. And you?
Yes. You'd probably be surprised by him, but yes.
So I have to ask, why isn't he helping you out?
I don't want to involve him. It's a bit much.
Okay, that tells me what I need to know.
What?
Now don't take this the wrong way, but your thinking about this is all wrong.
How?
Too small. Basically, what I'm saying is that it's not about you.
It's very much about me.
No, this is about the evolution of entire cultures and species. It might even be about the fate of the galaxy if you believe the Rael. You play a part in that. A very minor part, given the nature of the events playing out here.
She started to argue, but he held up a hand.
However, he said, it is pivotal, and that's where your importance lies. You have a choice, Araminta. You can either be the small person, maybe try to run and hide, then someone will catch up with you, and depending on who they are, your role will be subsumed into their agenda. Don't make the mistake of thinking any of them will leave you alone to carry on as you see best. They won't.
And my other choice? She asked waspishly.
Try and beat them at their own game. Turn round, stop running, face them down, and use the power you've acquired to bring about your own tenets.
What are they?
Laryl laughed quietly. When you work that out, you'll make the second choice automatically. Then?
Universe, watch out.
Araminta slumped in the chair and gave his image a dirty look.
Why did I call you?
Practicality. Listen, you'll either get there or they'll catch you first, so don't worry about it. In the meantime, I'll give you my advice, which you can ignore as always, but at least my conscience will be clean knowing I did my very best to help you.
She pouted. I didn't always ignore what you said.
Excuse me, I must have missed the one time you said yes.
Go on then. I called you after all, so let's hear it.
Just let me take a moment. The galaxy's future, poised on what I have to say. This is a real moment to savor.
Get on with it.
His expression turned serious. Are you supplying Justine's dream?
Justine is dreaming.
Okay, well that answers that. Yes, she is. But she's gone into suspension, so that removes her from the outcome for a while. Which brings us back to you and your proven influence on the Sky Lord. If that is to mean anything, you have to use it. Talk to the Sky Lord again.
I can't. They have some way of tracking me through the Gaia field. I only just got out of my apartment the last time, and that was mostly luck.
Ozzy.
All right. You have to try and find a way. You need to talk to it.
What do I say?
Try to explain how many people want to come to the void. Try to make it understand how catastrophic that would be for the rest of the galaxy. If you don't want to be taken over by Living Dream or a faction as their unwitting figurehead, then you have to bring this to an end.
Yeah, she said, exhaling heavily. I suppose I see that.
I'll try using the Gaia field again,
Try and see if I can find a way round them finding me. That's a good start. It sounds like you have a different ability to everyone else, so there's a chance it'll work in your favor. Here's an idea. If you can use the Gaia field without them realizing, you might want to check out Inigo's dreams. At least you'll have a better understanding what you're up against. Failing that, you're supposed to be able to commune with the Sylphan Mother Home. Who knows what they'll say? Thank you. That's actually useful? Very. All right, then. Now, what about you? Where are you staying? I haven't got anywhere. You're in the Spanish Crepes office, right? Yes. Bottom drawer of my desk, you'll find a bunch of old manuals. Underneath them are some cash coins, untraceable. She held them up, trying not to smirk.
Ozzie, he muttered.
I never did fool you, did I? Not much. All right. There's a couple of thousand Vyosha pounds loaded in. That'll help. Do you know about Warung Transport?
No.
Okay, I'm not totally useless then. It's another company I ran. A garage unit in the building two down from where you are now. There's a fully licensed cab inside. Just one. That's all the company owns. I can load the activation code in from here, so it'll be ready when you get to it. Now listen. There's some interesting software in its management system which allows you to avoid being tracked by the city control network.
Why? She asked.
He gave an embarrassed shrug. It might be useful if there were things you wanted to move around town without drawing too much attention to yourself.
Oh, Laryl.
There was concern as well as exasperation in her tone.
Those days are over, he said.
It also has a Unisphere node. I'll remote switch it to standby. You can use it any time to call me. No one else will be able to access it.
Thank you.
Araminta?
Yes?
I'm glad it was me you called. I'm glad I can help. She stared at his image for a long moment.
Why did you pick me? She asked quietly.
Oldest reason for a man to have.
You're gorgeous.
Ridiculously, she knew she was almost blushing. Don't change too much to become higher.
You know me.
Good luck. Call me when you need to.
Bye, Laryl.
She switched off the management array and the cybersphere node, then went out to check on Warung Transport. The Purus and the Congo slid unnoticed among the awesome Okusan Empire fleet as it raced towards the Commonwealth at 4.5 light-years per hour. A detailed scan revealed no craft other than the Star Slayers plunging onward through their wormholes. Whoever the Okusan Empire's allies were, they had a drive technology at least equal to the Commonwealth Navy ships. They took up a position a kilometer behind the new command vessel and began to interfere with its continuous wormhole. After a sharp tussle of exotic energy, the big Star Slayer vessel was torn back into normal space-time, its reaction control rockets firing continually to kill the errant rotation it picked up during the abrupt transition. Random flares of light slithered over its dark ovoid hull as the force field generators tried to regain equilibrium while the FTL drive's death throes spun out residual energy fluctuations. Both the Purus and the Congo dropped out of hyperdrive. A featureless spherical starship appeared beside the wrecked Star Slayer. The Huron, the Nyasa, and the Baikal shed their stealth effect. The three capital-class starships were almost as large as the Star Slayer, and infinitely more potent. A second spherical starship materialized 5 kilometers from the first. The Onega and the Torrens revealed themselves. For 3 seconds, nothing happened. The humans held their breath. Both the alien vessels opened fire. It was 90 seconds before the ultra-secure TD link to Pentagon 2 was re-established. The energy storm unleashed by the hellish firefight had strained the local structure of space-time to a degree which even affected the underlying quantum fields, severing the link. Admiral Casimir reviewed the updated situation fast. Both of the unknown ships had been destroyed, as had the Congo, while the Torrens had suffered so much damage it was unable to fight, though the crew survived. Most of the Star Slayer's hull had evaporated from the titanic energy bursts, even though no one had aimed at it. What was left of the outer structure was glowing cherry red and bubbling furiously around the edges.
Not completely invincible, then, Ilanthe said in a relieved tone.
So it would appear, the Admiral agreed.
They were all waiting to see if any more of the allies accompanying the fleet would turn back to assist their colleagues. The capital-class ships had managed to detect 50 stealthed hyperdrives secreted amid the star slayers, a truly formidable force.
Maybe not invincible, but just about unstoppable, Crispin said.
Do we have an equal number of capital-class warships, Admiral?
We have 39 within deployment range, Casimir told the depleted Exo-Protectorate Council.
He was dismayed that it was his own family that was missing. Whoever it was who had released his mother's dream into the Gaia field wasn't coming forward. Not that knowing their identity would be of any use. She would remain in suspension for some time. But it irked him to know that someone could reach her. Even more dismaying was Gore's non-appearance. When Casimir convened the Exo-Protectorate Council, Gore's U-Shadow reported him as unavailable. Casimir couldn't imagine what would keep his grandfather from attending, especially as his absence would allow Ilanthe to dominate the council. Not, he admitted to himself, that the outcome was going to be anything other than the one he really didn't want.
The remaining unknowns are staying with the fleet, reported Sorex, the Onega's captain.
Excellent, Casimir replied. Could you get in close for a scan of the wreckage, please?
So the fleet can be eliminated? Creewen asked urgently.
Numerically it would be difficult, Casimir said as the
Onega dispatched a swarm of sensor drones towards the largest chunk of wreckage from the second spherical ship.
As well as the unknowns, there are also 900 star slayers to consider. Our combined river and capital class ships would probably defeat them, but the cost would be severe. We'd be left with very few vessels.
Then we know what needs to be done, Ilanthe said. I believe there is one class of ship more powerful than the capital class.
Yes,
Casimir said with extreme reluctance.
Admiral, Sorex called, high-resolution sensors are combining.
Oh, great, Ozzy!
Casimir and the rest of the Exo-Protectorate Council stared silently at the sensor results which appeared above the big table. The little drones were flitting through the broken compartments and passageways of the spherical warship, contributing their separate scans to a cohesive image. The battered chunk of hardware was texture-perfect, right down to individual structural components. Metal around the outside was still hot enough to glow. It was also terribly radioactive. Odd pieces of charred biological matter drifted around the compartments, torn from alien bodies as explosions and energy pulses ripped through the ship. Right in the middle, the bodies were larger. Intact. The drones concentrated on one. Casimir stared at the terribly familiar pear-shaped torso, with four gristly ridges running its length. Four stubby legs protruded from the curving base, while arms branched out of the body just above the legs, each one ending in an efficient quad-pincer arrangement. At the top of the body, four small mouth trunks were open, drifting in zero-g like a seaweed in a slow current. Between them were the sensory stalks, rigid in death, each one fused to a neat electronic module.
That can't be, Crispin exclaimed. It can't. We contained them all 1,200 years ago. All of them.
It is, Ilanthe said emotionlessly. Yes, Casimir said, fighting both shock and a tinge of fear. An immotile. The Arcasan Empire has acquired primes as its allies.
The noise of ice crystals smashing themselves to sparkling dust on the ground crawler's metal shell was making conversation difficult inside. Even under the constant barrage by the wild elements, the vehicle hadn't moved. It was wedged fast in the fissure, with its narrow front windows covered by dirty granules which had filled the gaps around it. Minor quakes continued to shake it about, but they only seemed to tighten the fissure's grip. Several times, the thick metal bodywork had groaned in protest. Corilin sat awkwardly on top of the two forward seats, a blanket wrapped round her shoulders. Inigo was using an auxiliary console to squat beside her.
Why did you never dream again?
Corilin asked.
The Water Walker's era was over, Inigo said. You know that. There were no more dreams to be had.
But if you had one following his ascent to the nebulas, there must have been others. You said it came from a descendant. He had many children.
Inigo shook his head. His eyes glinted in the console's moiré radiance as he gazed at his old lover. We witnessed everything we needed to. I sustained hope in billions of people for centuries. That's enough. Corilin studied the face looming above her. So familiar, yet the darkened skin and bad brown hair made him seem colder somehow. This wasn't quite the old Inigo she'd known and loved. After all, it's been 70 years. Dreams don't always end like the water walkers did. And I dreamed so hard about this moment.
Please, she began.
The atmosphere howled at a volume which was painful on her ears. She gripped the chair, fearful that this was the final quake, the one that would send them falling into the planet's imploding core.
It's all right, Inigo's soft voice reassured her. Just the storm.
She grinned uncomfortably. That voice hadn't changed, and the reassurance she gained from it was immeasurable. So often she had heard his strident messages to the devout gathered in Golden Park, and equally the tenderness when they were alone. Every time it contained total conviction. If he said it was just the storm, then it was so.
Can you dream again? She asked.
The cabin lights flickered. Red warnings appeared on the console as the tortured air outside wailed stridently. Inigo's fingers stroked her cheek.
What is it you want? He asked, his mind lustrous with compassion.
I want to go to Querentia one last time, she told him. I want to walk through Lilylight's arcades. I want to take a gondola ride down the Great Major Canal. I want to stand on Christabel's Hortus as dawn comes up over the city.
She gripped his hand.
Just us. Is that such a terrible thing to ask?
No, he said. It's a beautiful thing to desire.
Take us there, until the end.
The tears were full-formed now, rolling down his cheeks.
I can't, my love. I'm so sorry.
No, she cried. Inigo, please.
We can dream any of the Water Walker's dreams together. Any. Just pick one.
No. I know them all. Even his last one. I want to know what happened after. If you won't take me there as it is now, then show me that final dream you had.
Corilin, do you still trust me?
Of course.
Then don't ask this. Let us visit Ediard when he drops Master Cherix into Birmingham Pool, or as he confronts Bice and the regiment in Sampaloc. They are such wonderful times. He shows people their future can be different to the one they thought they were condemned to.
Why? She pleaded. Tell me why.
The storm noise ended. It cut off so fast that Corilin thought she had suddenly gone deaf.
This is it. No regrets?
Well, not many.
Oh, shit.
Inigo was looking up towards the rear of the cabin.
It's all right, she said valiantly. We're together.
Uh-huh.
He shook his head, straightening up. Corilin wriggled into a precarious near-sitting position.
What?
The lady must hate us. She's guided us to a genuine fate worse than death.
Inigo, what are you...
A blinding green flash filled the cabin. Corilin squeezed her eyes shut in reflex. Her optic nerves were shining a blazing, whitened scarlet afterimage into her brain. She yelled in panic as some potent force slammed her sideways, sending her tumbling painfully down the side of the chairs to jam herself into the narrow space below. Her good arm waved round frantically.
Inigo!
Then she was abruptly aware of a fearsomely cold air flowing across her. She drew a shocked breath, feeling it freeze burning down her mouth and throat. Her vision was slowly recovering. She blinked to see Inigo braced on the console above her, clad in a shimmering force field. He was still looking up, almost dreading what she'd see. Corilin followed his gaze. The rear two-thirds of the ground crawler cabin had completely vanished. Where it had been, grey ice particles were drifting slowly downwards through a funereal sky. Behind them, slivers of purple static writhed across the broad force field dome that now encased them in a bubble of serenity. A human figure was silhouetted against the curtailed storm, an integral force field providing additional protection from the wicked elements. Corilin blinked again,
trying to gain some focus through the sharp scintillations of her bruised retinas. Secondary thought routines in her macrocellular clusters managed to resolve the man's features.
"Oh, lady, fuck it," she groaned, and slumped back down.
"Well, well," Aaron said cheerfully. "Fancy meeting you two here."